Right now, I want you to pretend that you're at a self-service recycling station at a food establishment. You have a tray covered in napkins and containers, and the bins in front of you are labeled recycling, compost, and landfill. You inspect a disposable spoon like it's the Rosetta Stone, trying to figure out which bin to throw it in, and you start questioning every choice we've collectively made as a society that led you to this moment, where you're spending more time trying to recycle a disposable spoon than you would have spent washing a real one. I'm Gina Kaufman, and recycling is finally popular, but it's still confusing. We're going to address all of the confusion out there, as well as the future of recycling in the metro on KCUR's Central Standard. Call 816-235-2888 with your questions and woes. What's the thing you don't want to put in a landfill but can't figure out how to recycle? 816-235-2888. Here, I'll start. Matt Riggs is the Recycling Outreach Coordinator for the Mid-America Regional Council. And Matt, can I recycle light bulbs?
Yes, you can, but it depends on what kind you're talking about.
I have to know my light bulbs.
You have to know your light bulbs. That's right. So really, the only kind of light bulb that can be recycled, well, theoretically, they all can be recycled. But the only one you need to recycle are the fluorescent ones, the little squiggly compact fluorescent ones, and the tubes, because those have mercury in them.
Whoa,
and last I checked, mercury wasn't good to get in your body or the water, et cetera. So
generally a bad idea, yeah. Mm-hmm. How do you recycle a light bulb?
Well, there's several different options. People can take it to their local household hazardous waste facility, which is one option. And the other option are retail. So you can take the little compact fluorescent bulbs to Home Depot, to Lowe's, and some other retail places that take those back.
So when you say those are the only ones I need to recycle, but let's say I'm just a person who wants to, what about the other kinds of light bulbs out there?
Well, the other kind of light bulbs, like your old style incandescent or halogen or, you know, LED bulbs, are all made of materials that could be recycled, such as glass and metal and that kind of thing. It's just that the economics aren't there, and there's nobody collecting those right now for recycling.
So technically you could, but in reality you can't.
Right.
Okay.
At least for now you can't.
What about the layer of plastic film that covers a frozen entree?
Well, basically almost any frozen food container is not recyclable, except for plastic, you know, like your plastic Blue Bunny ice cream tub, you can recycle that. But any frozen food bag, such as vegetables or fruit or whatever, is not recyclable.
Why not?
Because that type of plastic has several different resins of plastic in it, which makes it non-recyclable. And then you have stuff like the boxes of food, like your Stouffer's, whatever, lasagna or whatever comes in. And it looks like paper, but unfortunately it has a very thin layer of plastic on it. So in general, no to all frozen food packaging, whether it's boxes or bags, just like plastic tubs are about all you can recycle.
So people with major environmental concerns need to sort of wean themselves off of the convenience of frozen foods, it sounds like, because recycling isn't going to fix this for us.
Yeah, well, I mean, you got to keep it in perspective. You know, I'm not asking people to stop going to the grocery store because that'd be one quick way to reduce all your packaging waste.
For sure.
It's not realistic. So it really requires you just to be a smarter shopper and to always think, you know, what can I use? What can I buy that's recyclable? Or how could I take it home or buy something in a durable container that doesn't have to be recycled or trashed?
So we're going to take questions from our listeners kind of along these lines about what you can recycle, what you can't, and how it's going in our area more broadly. But I want to talk to you about that bigger question. The recycling center at Metro North Mall closed in October. I understand that that was the biggest free drop-off recycling center in town.
Well, it was definitely one of the most popular ones, and it's one of the ones that's been around a long time, so a lot of people have come to depend on that. But unfortunately, the city didn't own that property, and it was on commercial real estate that they wanted to redevelop, so it got closed. Now, the good news is the city is trying to relocate it in the Northland, and hopefully they'll do that sometime in the next year or so. But there's no decisions have been made and no timelines issued. So, but it should be coming back.
Is your sense that recycling is gaining traction in a serious way in Kansas City when you look at the sweep of time? And
Right now it is and it isn't. It is in the fact that a lot of people, a lot more people have curbside recycling now than they did 5-10 years ago, because a lot of the local cities are contracting directly with the hauler to provide that service to the whole city. So that's increased people's access a lot. Also, people's mindset, you know, their minds have been open a little bit more, especially by all the news about plastic pollution from large chunks found in the dead whale to the microplastics that, you know, contaminate the lowest level of our food chain. So that whole people are just more aware of the single-use culture that we live in. So that has helped raise awareness and behavior change.
Is that – do you see that reflected in the amount of, like, regular trash pickup in town? Has that gone down?
Well, actually, the trash is more tied to the economy.
Whoa. So, okay, that makes sense.
So – and really all of recycling is. So since the downturn in 2008, things have slowly gotten better. And as the economy gets better, more trash gets produced.
Because we buy more stuff.
Because we buy more stuff, right. So it's kind of a double-edged sword.
Man, and so recycling doesn't seem to be the big factor in how much trash we're throwing away.
We each produce about 7 pounds of trash per day as individuals. And that's really the only number we have, because there are no regulations or ordinances that say we have to give us numbers on the measured, on what recycling you're throwing out. So over time, that number has gone up and down, and it's up right now. But, you know, like I said, access is improving in terms of curbside recycling, which really is the most convenient form of recycling.
It is. I mean, what we're kind of getting at, I feel like, though, is a lot of people do want to reduce their waste. But when you talk about something like, well, the best thing would be to just stop going to the grocery store, but that's not realistic. Mm-hmm. And that dance that we do between what is realistic in our culture and our economy versus what we know would be better, that's a tough thing that we all live with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, there's very simple things that we can do, like, for instance, just taking durable bags to the grocery store. That reduces waste a lot, because you can use durable bags hundreds of times for the one use you get out of a plastic bag. You can use a durable mug or cup to get your beverage in, which can be used 1,000 times for that one disposable cup. So there's simple steps like that that people can take. But to really be like, I want to eliminate all the plastic waste in my life, well, that's a slightly more of an undertaking. So if
it
you're
seems
really
like it has to be on some level a top-down thing, just in terms of businesses and maybe politics. I don't know.
Right. I mean, we work at kind of both levels at the Solid Waste District. Our primary customers, because we're Mid-America Regional Council, are the local cities and counties. So they're our partners in this. And we rely on them to kind of do more of the top-down message. You know, this is what you need to recycle, what you don't. Here's your services. But we really work on a grassroots level. We're just out there talking to people at churches and schools and programs like this, and really trying to get the information out there about what you should and shouldn't recycle. So a lot of it's just grassroots, word of mouth. People follow us on Facebook. People get on our website. They tell their friends, families, and neighbors. So,
but when I say top down, I also kind of mean like, what are your actual options? Like when things are excessively packaged and you need that thing, it's how do we just end up with less stuff? Is there?
Well, you know, one top down strategy is product stewardship, which is working with the companies that actually manufacture our things to not only make the item itself fully recyclable, but also to reduce the packaging and make sure all the packaging it comes in is recyclable. But as you can imagine, up against political and economic factors, that's a pretty steep row. So so it's going to take a while. There are efforts in Missouri right now to implement product stewardship initiatives, but
in the meantime, we're going to be responsible for our own waste.
Right, pretty much. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Let's talk to Lauren in Kansas City. She's calling us at 816-235-2888. Hi, Lauren.
Hi. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Good. So I have a question about recycling. Yeah, every day I pick up my dog's poop and you put it in a plastic bag that's not biodegradable. And then usually it goes in a bigger trash bag that goes to a landfill. Yeah, and I think about it every day. Like, is there not a better way to deal with this? I don't know.
So Matt Riggs of the Mid-America Regional Council, solutions for Lauren, who wants to be responsible with her dog waste.
Mm-hmm. Well, first off, thank you for picking it up, because that's a tremendous problem in our water, all the bacteria and stuff that's dangerous that comes from pet waste. But really, there's a couple other options you can use, and a lot of it has to do with how much quantity we're talking. So if you have one small to medium-sized dog, you can actually pick up the dog doo and throw it in the toilet and flush it down, because it gets treated just like human sewage. Another option is, if you don't have a lot, you can bury it in your yard. There's all kinds of stuff on the web for about how you should dig a little furrow, yay deep, put it in there, and it will decompose naturally underground.
And please record the conversations with your neighbors while you're doing this, because I would love to hear them.
Right, of course. Like, for instance, we have three dogs. Two of them are huge dogs, so the quantity for us means it goes in the trash. But better to go in the landfill than to just be sitting in the yard and ending up in our storm drains and in our creeks and rivers. So.
And then, as long as we're on this topic, what about cat waste? Is there an environmentally friendly way of dealing with that, or no? Litter boxes are just going to be...
Yeah, unfortunately, you know, there's some components of solid waste, even pet waste, that there's not a really good solution for. I'm sure there are some greener ways to dispose of cat waste, but not having cats myself, I really haven't researched that. So.
Maybe some local entrepreneurs will take this
right,
on.
Right.
All right. Nick in Lawrence, welcome to KCUR Central Standard. What do you want to share?
Hi there. How are y'all doing?
Good.
I had a question about lids, plastic lids, metal lids, and even down to bottle caps. And I was also wondering about waxed juice containers or milk containers.
All right.
Paper.
So this is a tricky one. When one object has multiple materials on it, mm-hmm. Yes, that's confusing.
All right. So caps and lids, they are recyclable, because you're either talking about metal caps or lids or plastic caps or lids. Really, the best thing to do with plastic caps and lids is to, when you're through with the container, to put it back on the container. That helps to make sure that it gets through the recycling machinery, because lids are considered smalls, which are anything that drop through the machinery and just end up being swept up and thrown out. So plastic, put it back on. If you have metal caps and lids, a really good thing to do is to keep like a large tin can, like something you bought some canned peaches or something in, like under your sink or something, and fill it about halfway full with soup can lids, beer bottle caps, etc. And when it gets about halfway full, just crimp the top shut, throw the whole thing in the recycling bin, and that ensures that those small things get recycled. In terms of the wax cartons, those are like the gable top cartons or the flat top. Generally, they all have a plastic cap on the top of them. Things for like milk, juice, broth, wine, et cetera, like that. And then the kids' drinks, a lot of them come in the little boxes. Those are all 100% recyclable. Those are called aseptic containers. Just give them a quick rinse and put the cap back on, and you can put those in your curbside bin.
All right. We have a tweet from Courtney, who works at a library, so this is not surprising, but she says that she has a bunch of books that got damaged when her basement flooded, and someone told her she could put the books in the recycling bins, but they're flood damaged, so she's not sure. Can she put them in, or does she need to toss them in the trash?
She definitely shouldn't put them in her recycling bin, because unless it's a small paperback here and there, most recyclers don't want a lot of big hardcover books or people's, you know, library contents dumped in the bin, because those have binding, a lot of glue, they're sewn, all that. A lot of them have like leather or vinyl covers and stuff. So it's really not ideal for a recycling stream. But if you have like flood damage stuff, I would say, depending on how damage is, it probably should just go in the trash. There is a place in town called Books KC that has some drop-off locations that recycle books. But I wouldn't suggest necessarily recycling them unless they're just very minimal water damage.
Why wouldn't you recommend recycling them?
Because paper, once paper has dirt on it and mold and mildew growing on it and any other contamination like that, the paper is worthless. So it really just, it's just not worth it.
Can I ask you something? I mean, this idea of going item by item with every imaginable piece of trash that we create through our own consumption, it is overwhelming. Mm-hmm. And most things that I have to answer for myself on a case-by-case basis, I have some larger, big-picture understanding that helps me make those calls without looking it up every time. Mm-hmm. This almost feels like trying to figure out how to use the Dewey Decimal System when you don't know the alphabet, and you have to keep looking up what order the letters go in or something.
Right. Uh-huh.
When you're answering these questions, have you just memorized all these cases, or do you have that kind of big-picture understanding that allows you to just be like, oh, yeah, I know?
Yeah, both, because I've been in this business for 20 years, so I have accumulated some knowledge. But I guess, there are thousands of consumer items out there. They're all made of different things and packaged differently. Some of their packaging, and some of them are recyclable and some are not. So what I suggest people do who are confused is start with the big, easy stuff categories we all have. We recently, this past year, put together the Recycle Better flyer, which is on our website, recyclespot.org. And it gives a basic yes and no list for your curbside bin. So it covers all the major categories that should go in there and all the major categories of stuff that people are putting in there that they shouldn't. Just because something's on the no list doesn't mean it's not recyclable. It just means it can't go in your curbside bin. And that's where our website comes in, because if you have an old TV or you have paint or glass bottles, you can look it up on Recycle Spot and it'll tell you the closest location you can take that item.
Is that a pretty new development?
Recyclespot.org?
Yeah.
No, it's actually been around since 2006, but we've just kept updating it over time. It gets better all the time. And so.
And people are finally using it, maybe.
Yes, yes. Uh-huh.
Well, let's talk to Tom in Parkville. Hi, Tom.
Good morning.
What do you want to recycle?
Well, I think everybody on the planet uses AA, AAA, CD, and whatever alkaline batteries, and 99% of them aren't rechargeable. What do you do with those guys?
And what city are you from?
Parkville.
Well, there's a couple places that take them. Probably your best bet is to take them to the Household Hazardous Waste Facility in Kansas City, Missouri. Parkville basically pays into that program, which means you as a resident have free access to that program. And that facility takes anything with the label danger, caution, warning on it, which includes all types of batteries. So they take your lead acid batteries, all your rechargeable batteries, but they also take all the single use batteries like the AA, 9-volt button batteries and all that. So that's probably your best option for those.
So this gets at the fact that recycling isn't just one way everywhere you go. The answers to some of these questions vary from municipality to municipality. So things that we take as just a given of how recycling works in Kansas City can actually be very different in another place. What do you think of as sort of like the main particularities of our recycling process here?
Well, you have to remember that we cover two states. MARC itself covers 9 counties, 4 in Kansas and 5 in Missouri. We have about 119 cities, and things are done differently in pretty much every one of those cities to some degree. So somebody in Smithville has different recycling options than somebody in downtown KCMO versus somebody in Olathe or Overland Park. They do vary to some degree.
Within the larger metro, do you see a community that does this especially well, especially effectively? And can you explain the difference?
Well, for instance, here in KCMO, they have a very good variety. They have a nice, I guess you call it a suite of solid waste services that's very comprehensive, which is very nice. They have curbside recycling, household hazardous waste. They pick up yard waste. They have bulky item. They have cleanup days. You know, they have all these things that citizens can use as services. So that's good in and of itself, because not every community can offer that full suite of solid waste services. And then you have some communities that have really stepped up to the plate in terms of doing outreach and education, which is really one of the most crucial components, which has really been lacking. And those include City of Kearney and City of Platte City, who have both recently done citizen awareness campaigns. They sent out postcards to every resident, say, recycle this, don't recycle that.
And then all those postcards went in the recycling bin.
Of course they did. Of course they did. So, yeah. So those are some examples of things being done well in our area.
Well, you can call 816-235-2888 with your recycling questions, whether it's the thing you're not sure how to dispose of responsibly or question about how it works here and what's on the horizon. 816-235-2888. I'm talking with Matt Riggs of the Mid-America Regional Council. Be right back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard, and we're getting an update on recycling in the Kansas City Metro with Matt Riggs of the Mid-America Regional Council. We're going to get right back to your questions about recycling, but I do have a couple of questions just about what's changed in Kansas City. First of all, time was you could not recycle glass in Kansas City. Then Ripple Glass stepped in, and they have big purple bins set up all over town. How has that changed things?
The glass recycling specifically?
Yeah.
Well, back in the day, when curbside was in its infancy in our area, they accepted glass curbside. And then they decided economically it didn't make sense for safety reasons, et cetera. So they took it away. And then once Ripple came on the scene about 10 years ago, it changed everything because, like you said, they provide drop-off facilities throughout the metro area at local grocery stores and liquor stores. They work a lot with local bars and restaurants to provide recycling, glass recycling for them, which is most of our glass comes from the restaurant and bar industry.
It's interesting to me how people have changed their behavior patterns to make dropping off the glass recycling just part of life.
Mm-hmm.
That seems like it can be. Whatever happened there could be useful information as far as just incorporating more of these extra, what feel now like extra steps.
Mm-hmm. Well, like I said, curbside recycling is the most convenient. When you can put something in a bin and just put it out your curb, that's the most convenient. Unfortunately, there's a lot of items you can recycle that require being dropped off. So really what it comes down to is the convenience and ease with which you can drop those things off. So if you're running to the store and you can use the Ripple bin that's at that store, that's great. Or if you have an old TV and you want to recycle it, you can go just down the mall and take it to Best Buy and recycle it there. So it's all about convenience in terms of having places you can recycle that are close, that are not complicated to figure out what they take and what they don't take, and that there are options for those items.
Let's get back to our callers. I want to talk to Ellen in Overland Park. Hi, Ellen.
Hey, good morning. So I have an interesting question for you. I inherited a whole bunch of plastic slide carousels that belonged to my dad. And we try and recycle absolutely everything we possibly can. And I do not want to throw these in the trash, but they were made before anybody indicated whether things were recyclable or not. Have you come across this issue?
Well, the slide carousels would fall under the general category of electronic waste, which is basically anything that runs on a quarter battery, no matter how old it is, which slide carousels are at least 30 years old, if not older. So there are a couple great places in town that basically take anything that runs on a quarter battery, and those are the Surplus Exchange and Midwest Recycling Center. They take a very wide variety, so I would say those would be your best bet for getting rid of, any electronic waste, but especially some of the more old or oddball items that your average Best Buy store or other place that takes, you know, the average consumer electronics may be like, I don't even know what that is. I don't know if we can take it. So,
okay, a couple follow-ups to this question, though. One is that Ellen has used this thing for a very long time, which it seems like prolonging our use of things could be also part of a better solution to our waste problem writ large. So, like, the three R's, reduce, reuse, recycle. Mm-hmm. Recycle is just one of those. And I would maybe add to it, just personally, just wear things out a little more.
Right, right. So the whole, in our business, we work under the waste, the solid waste hierarchy. Of course, we have a hierarchy. And recycling is actually somewhere in the middle. Below it, you have throwing it in the trash, burning it for energy, then recycling and composting, then reuse, then waste reduction. So really what we want to get to eventually is waste reduction, because you're not creating the waste in the first place. And when you're not creating waste, it's not like, does this go in the trash? Does it have to be recycled? Because it wasn't created in the first place. So, you know, back during the Depression and World War II, when we didn't have all these items and we were very restricted by the economic situation and the war we were fighting, we had to make do, you know. And so people really learned how to reuse and recycle everything over and over again. And given the current status of our environment, which from a climatic standpoint, which recycling is very much related to, we're going to have to get back to that eventually, because...
Well, you say eventually, but some of these newest reports don't give a lot of time.
Right.
Eventually, so, like, fast.
Right, right, like, start right now, right.
So, I mean, along those lines, though, of the big picture things that are changing, one of those changes that's gotten a lot of attention is that China is no longer accepting our plastics, right? And mm-hmm. so this whole model of recycling was built around a supply and demand chain that's in flux.
Right, right. So, yeah, so... China has imposed a couple of bans, and in response to our tariffs on them, have imposed tariffs on us. And so the bottom line is less and less stuff is making it to China as the years go by.
Where is it going instead?
Well, there's other, especially Asian countries, that have some recycling markets. Some of it's gone there, but once China imposed the ban on plastic and mixed plastic and mixed paper, we immediately like, okay, Vietnam, will you take our stuff? And they're like, okay. And they're like, no, whoa, this is way too much stuff. So we overwhelmed those other markets immediately. So what we're really having to do in response to this is look domestically back on our own shores, like how we're going to have to learn how to use this, reuse this stuff and recycle it right here in our own territory. And also,
any big breakthroughs on that?
Well, China has decided to come over here and have a little hand in the quality control. So they've actually bought up some paper pulp mills, and they started some plastic pelletizing operations so that they can have better quality control and actually get what they want in terms of paper pulp and the type of plastic, and then they can ship it back to China without being part of the whole waste ban. So they're actually stepping up to the plate, and as well as us. So
one thing that I understand has also changed in relation to all of this is that recycling is not profitable financially.
Right, and a large part of that is because China doesn't want it anymore. So
right.
we have to pay a lot more to find other markets for it. So those costs are passed right down to the consumer.
So is the cost issue, does that spell trouble for recycling as like a project or no? Are people willing to pay because they care?
Well, some are and some aren't. For instance, you know, because of the increase in cost of recycling, we've lost about 14 or so drop-off recycling centers in the greater Kansas City area in the last 2 or 3 years because it just cost too much to operate them, and people were putting too many contaminants in it that shouldn't go in there. I mean, also what a lot of residents have noticed is, like, they used to take their stuff up to the local school or the local church, which said, yeah, bring us your stuff. Well, 10, 15 years ago, you could get paid by the recycling company for that stuff. Now you're having to pay to get rid of it. So instead of a financial benefit to that organization you thought you're helping, you're actually causing them a problem because now they have to pay to recycle. So that's why
we are so burdened by our own stuff.
Right, right. So that's why a lot of the schools and churches don't recycle anymore.
Let's talk to Georgia in Overland Park. Hi, Georgia.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. First of all, I just wanted to give a shout out at Matt. I worked with him at BTG many years ago, and I'm so glad to know that he's still working at it at Mark.
BTG, that's Bridging the Gap.
Bridging the Gap, yes. I continue to be a rabid recycler, and I find it harder and harder
rabid
to live in this world. I just, you know, like everybody else, you end up getting stuff. It's like, what am I going to do with this? But I wanted to just say two things. One is a rant that we really do need to reduce what we use and use it more wisely. And never take a plastic bag. Always carry your own, no matter where you're going. And then two, I wanted to know if Matt would, because I've got one source, and I wanted to know if Matt would talk about recycling of textiles.
Okay.
Thank you.
Recycling textiles, and this is kind of a big one because especially like clothing that has been worn out to the point that you're not going to donate that to someone. That would just, it would almost be rude.
Right. And that's the way, I mean, that's obviously the right way to think about it because you don't want to just hand somebody your trash, you know, because they need good, warm, secure clothing. But the fact of the matter is that very little of the clothing that ever gets donated to your average Goodwill or Salvation Army actually makes it out onto the sales floor. A lot of that stuff that may have a little tear in it, a little stain, et cetera, gets shipped off and sold in third world countries where they're happy just to have a shirt, you know. And a lot of it that's even in worse shape, they recycle it. They go to rag dealers and other companies that make them into all kinds of recycled products. So in general, what we tell people is if they have items of clothing that are stained or torn or just hopelessly out of style and they're just like, I can't give this to somebody, you can go ahead and donate it. Really, and if you're using a major chain like Salvation Army or Goodwill, they have the processes in place to process it and make use of it, whether it's can go to the showroom floor or there just has to be made into a rag, they can use it.
There's a retailer where I was shopping and there was a message over the intercom saying, you know, bring in your used clothing, whether you bought it here or not, and we'll recycle it for you. I mean, not turning it into other fibers, because I asked at the counter for details. And it's like, it's you can recycle textiles into other things.
Mm-hmm.
Are a lot of retailers doing that kind of thing?
There are a handful of them out there that are. I was at Oak Park Mall not too long ago, and I noticed one place there, it was H&M or someplace like that, offered the jeans recycling or something. So there are a few of them that are offering that. But really, what that goes back to is what I spoke about earlier, which is producer responsibility. Really, every store that sells anything should seriously think about, okay, what are we selling and how can we help people properly get rid of it at its end of its life. So
yeah. Okay. Well, let's get back to our callers. We've got, let's see, Leslie in Overland Park. Hi, Leslie.
Hi. Hi. Hi, guys. Recycling is a big subject for me, so I had to actually make notes and just try to focus myself. So I just started working at a doctor's office and I became known as the one who would carry all the boxes down to recycle and such. But I was mainly concerned about apartment complexes. A friend of mine just moved to an apartment complex, and she's really concerned that, you know, many apartment complexes just, or maybe none of them, provide any sort of way to recycle. And the person just kind of has to scour the city looking for some bin that they can just go regularly dump things in. Is that something that Mark is working with?
Yeah, so let's get an answer on apartment complexes. And I'm also curious about other places where lots of people go, like lots of people live on college campuses or just schools, period, spending lots of time in.
Well, the college campuses are doing a lot better than the multifamily, definitely. UMKC has an excellent program, as do other area universities and colleges, the community colleges, et cetera. They all have a really good handle on solid waste. Multifamily is very problematic. We have a project that we funded through our grant program through Bridging the Gap, which actually is pinpointing helping getting multifamily complexes to provide recycling for the residents. There are a handful around the metro area of apartments that do provide it. But again, it comes back to really, first off, the cost. Most property managers don't want to foot that bill for recycling since it costs to do it now. And then logistics is a really big issue, especially in your older model apartment buildings that have like no space in the alley for a dumpster, or if they have very strict dumpster corral regulations and their dumpster corral only currently houses a trash bin, and that to do recycling, they'd have to expand the dumpster corral. Plus, logistically speaking, so that's some of the logistics, but also just the highly transient population. You have people coming and going all the time. So the education curve is enormous, especially if somebody's there for 6 months or a year. So we're working on it, but it's a very slow uphill battle.
Well, so before we go, you have a side hustle. You're an Elvis impersonator, but with like an environmental message.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering if you'd be willing to sing just a little bit of one of your favorite ditties to us before we go. just a taste.
Well, how about a little bit of Earth Day rock? Because, you know, Earth Day is April 22nd, but in our world, every day is Earth Day. So, well, the Earth needs your help, baby, can't you see? Because I really screwed up the land, air, and seas. Listen up and take a tip from old Greenie. Come on and do the Earth Day rock with me. Well, let's rock. Everybody, let's rock. Everybody's got to do more than talk and start dance to the Earth Day rock.
And you do not just Elvis songs. you do an acid rain to the tune of Purple Rain.
Right.
I love it.
Right. Rockin' for a Green World is takeoff on Neil Young's Rockin' for a Free World, etc. So.
Matt Riggs, with us from the Mid-America Regional Council. Thanks so much.
Oh, thank you very much.
I'm Gina Kaufman. Up next, the artistic potential of the old KCTV5 tower may finally be realized. Stay tuned for that story on KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And at 31st and Grand, there's an old transmission tower that looks pretty ordinary nowadays. But once upon a time, it would be lit up all over Midtown every night. It was iconic, like the Eiffel Tower, only not. So since it went dark, it's been mostly forgotten, but not by Jasper Malarney. He's been obsessed with powering the tower, as he puts it, for a long time, and his plan is finally getting some traction. He's here with me now. Hi, Jasper.
Hi, good morning.
So tell me the story of what got you interested in this tower.
So I think like anyone else who's lived in the city for more than 10 years, it was this centerpiece of the night sky. When it went dark, it became a void. And I think
when you say a centerpiece of the night sky, I want there are people who have no memory of this. So let's bring it to life for them. I remember people gathering on Midtown porches waiting for the lights to come on.
Sure.
And like cheering.
Yeah. So I mean, it's the highest structure in the city. It can be seen from, you know, if you're driving back from the airport, from I-70 out west. It can be seen very clearly from I-35 and Shawnee Mission Parkway. So it's got tremendous sort of reach in the city. You can see it from lots of different places. For me, as a teenager, driving around the city looking for places to skateboard, it was, you know, a sort of guide point to the center of the city. That's my earliest memory of it. In about 2007, I bought my house in Longfellow. It was visible from the rear deck there. And the view of the lights on the tower and, you say tomato being in the neighborhood kind of sealed the deal for me buying that house. Then it went dark shortly after. So since then, like a lot of other people, I've really missed the lights being on it.
And so you started what kind of a movement?
I suppose so. It's gotten a lot of positive responses. The project overall has gotten a lot of positive responses. You know, early on, tried things like crowdfunding and had a lot of positive responses on social media. It wasn't until we narrowed this down to be a true public art project that it gained real momentum.
Yeah, I mean, so when you say we, this is kind of a complicated story. You started poking around trying to do something about this. Then the momentum, at least publicly, kind of died for a while. And then now suddenly it's back looking more official than ever. And the whole thing, you're calling it Power the Tower. But can you fill in some of the gaps there? Like, what was happening behind the scenes?
Sure. Yeah. So Power the Tower is kind of the early brand that we came up with just to gain some traction on social media. We're sunsetting some of that and letting the piece take center stage now. So I had a good view of the tower from an office that I had in Briarcliff at the time, and just decided to do something creative with it. I just had the urge to pursue it. I cold called KCTV 15 or 20 times, finally got in touch with the director of engineering there, and I talked through the reality of a restorative project for the tower. So this is a little before framing it as public art and just looking at a restoration project. They let me know the current infrastructure was in too rough a shape to bring it back as it was. And if I haven't been on the tower myself, because I'm not qualified to do that, but the photos I've seen of the current infrastructure are fairly beaten up. So at that point, we decided replacing that with LEDs was the way to go. I built out the crowdfunding campaign.
When you say we, who are you talking about?
First, just me. Then I had a number of volunteers sign up to join the project as well. Design Ranch did some of the early design work pro bono to help us out.
Was this people who were also just sort of nostalgic for a time when they remembered this tower lit up in the night sky?
Yeah, the local artists as well. I had a videographer and a photographer, for example, volunteer. We rented a helicopter and took some shots of the tower to help us render what would be the piece. I had a friend do some 3D modeling of it, which is, you know, necessary to do early engineering on the project. So we went down lots of different rabbit holes trying to find the best way to execute this.
And so recently, Jim Woodfill has gotten involved. He's an artist. He teaches at the Kansas City Art Institute. But more importantly, he has done a lot of really prominent light installations in our cityscape and for other cities, too. Hi, Jim.
Hi.
So do you remember when the tower was lit up before?
I do. When I was a student, it was a prominent feature. I was a student at the Art Institute. It was a prominent feature of the sky. And I had a studio downtown and would drive, for 15 years, driving back and forth between Midtown and downtown and go right underneath the tower. And it was a dominant part of the landscape. And it was also an influential piece of engineering. And
how so?
Well, I mean, it's an amazing structure. It's totally pragmatic, unlike the Eiffel Tower, which is more of a kind of an iconic design structure. This had one simple idea for why the tower was made to get the ground plane 1,000 feet up in the air so that it could reach out over the curvature of the earth. That's kind of my geeky take on why I'm interested in it. It's a piece of infrastructure that's really effective at doing what it did, and it didn't do anything else. And lighting was kind of a celebration of the super pragmatic aspects of the tower.
That's kind of your thing, is noticing some piece of the built environment that has a function that we kind of overlook and drawing attention to it.
That's right. And I think as we looked at the tower and we looked at thinking about it as a public art project, the beautiful thing about it is that it's already here. You say it's overlooked. It's not overlooked to me. I look at it every morning when I drive into Midtown from the West Bottoms, and the sun hits it in a certain way. It's orange now, and it's quite a beautiful, amazing structure. It goes way up there with a really small footprint, and I guess for me, the idea of why, one of the reasons I wanted to get involved as an artist is to make sure we didn't foul that up. That it's like we could do the wrong thing with it. Let's make sure we do the right thing with it and respect the integrity of the tower.
What would be like the wrong thing?
Making it decorative, making it kind of a multi-purpose colored light show. I think one of the beautiful things about its early days is that it was just light. It was white light going up the four corners of it. When they changed it to red, white, and blue, it took on kind of a political cast. When they tried to show the weather with it, it kind of took on a little bit more of a utility kind of thing, and which wasn't actually that bad. But
yeah, I remember that, and I had the feeling like if we were going to consider it our Eiffel Tower, if we were, then to me, the idea that this dominant feature of a Midwestern cityscape would reflect like meteorological anxiety seemed very appropriate.
Well, and I think we've hit on that at this point. When you look at the tower now, you see the color of the sky behind it during the day. And that's kind of how we ended up with the idea of seeing the night bluely, which is the title of the piece, where we'll record the color of the sky during the day and play it back at night. And in some fashion, we're not sure exactly the nuance and the detail of that, but the idea of the full title of the work is also has a parenthesis behind it.
I like that you have to take out notes to tell us what it is. It's your project.
A single for short-term memory. And thinking of it as a signal for kind of trying to remember the day behind us and putting kind of a kinetic pace to the experience of seeing it.
When you first heard that someone was pursuing this, can you take me back to that moment of sort of being invited to participate in relighting this tower?
Yeah. You know, Jasper approached me a couple of times, and I guess the first time or two, I wasn't sure. I realized what a big project it was. And I wasn't sure whether there was a reality to it,
or whether this was just an obsessed person.
That's right. And it turns out it's some of both. but eventually, Kirsten, my partner, and I were walking her dog up on the west side, and I looked at the tower one night, and there were LED lights at the top of the tower, and I thought, uh-oh, he's doing this thing. And that was the first time I took him seriously about actually being able to get this thing cooking, and decided that the time was now to join the team.
So, Jasper, where does all this stand? This is a functioning transmission tower on private property. It seems tricky.
Yeah, certainly. There are a number of checkboxes we've got to work through. I think we've got a good sense of what they are, right? So we have to do environmental studies to make sure, you know, wildlife isn't impacted. We have to do an FAA study to make sure that everything we do is in compliance. There's engineering to ensure that the lights that we install are going to be withstand the weather. So, yes, there's a way to go, but I think we know what we're pursuing.
And Jim, a final note on the vision?
Well, I think as it unfolds, you'll see that we've attached a great deal of energy to making this a civic-wide discussion. We've brought on Jose Faust as a community engagement artist for the project, and we're excited about where it's going to go.
Well, Jim Whitfield, Jasper Malarney, thank you for talking about this whole concept of relighting the KCTV 5 tower. It's been fun, and I'm looking forward to updates.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Gina.
That's a wrap for today's show, but you can listen back to anything you might have missed or share these conversations with your friends at kcur.org/centralstandard. And you can have these conversations sent to you on your phone like a podcast. So sign up for that while you're there, kcur.org/centralstandard, and follow us on Twitter. We're at KCURCST. Tomorrow, there is a lot of pressure on parents to be involved in their kids' schools, but not all parents have equal time and resources to spare. And that disparity has been an invisible source of inequality from one school district to another. That conversation happens tomorrow, so join in. KCUR's Central Standard is produced by Melody Rowell with Coy Duggar, Suzanne Hogan, Chris Young, and intern Sophia Gillespie. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. I'm Gina Kaufman.